Good evening. I'm going to try to find a range for this thing here in front of me. On behalf of the Michigan State University Libraries, I'd like to welcome you to the first Michigan Writers Series event for this fall semester. And it's a great pleasure to me to be able to introduce my friend, Anita Skeen. She will tell you a great deal about herself, and she tells you a great deal about herself in her poems, so I won't do very much of that. But there's one comment in the introduction to her earlier book, Each Hand a Map, which I love, which says, Anita Skeen was born in 1946 and grew up outside of Big Chimney, West Virginia. She brought dogs into her house, took books into the woods, and filled her childhood. And then it goes on to describe her career a little bit. But I really love the image of bringing dogs into the house and taking books into the woods. I think that's really quite wonderful. Anita did her graduate work, got her degrees at Bowling Green, spent about 20 years teaching in Kansas, and has received different awards for excellence in teaching. And this I can well believe. I was fortunate enough to have taken one poetry workshop, not an academic one, but it gave me a chance to experience Anita as a teacher. And that was indeed a wonderful experience for a closet poet, one of those millions of wannabes with chronic writer's block. So it's really not a problem. I'm not going to ever punish the world by, you know, releasing bad poems. But the experience of having Anita for a teacher was a wonderful one. And in it, all her qualities, which make her such a wonderful poet, were clear as a teacher. Her kindness and warmth, but her integrity and a keen observation, and no compromise at all with excellence and drawing out the best in the people she was working with. And her gift of storytelling was one she helped other people to try to realize, because for Anita, I think poems are stories very much, more than with many poems, and that is one of the things I like so much about her work. So, a poet, a teacher, a wonderful, wonderful person, and I hope you will appreciate the storytelling in the poetry as she shares with us some of the geographies of women's lives. Anita.
I guess I'm wired, so I feel like I'm going to explode any minute that, you know, there's a terrorist package attached to my hip, so I'll try to pretend like it's not there. Thank you, Anne, for that wonderful introduction, and teaching is a very important aspect of my life, and lots of times when I read poetry or fiction, nobody mentions the teaching, so thank you for mentioning the teaching, because I think one of the things that has helped me become a good and a better poet is teaching all kinds of things. And so although I get frustrated with the academy because it doesn't give me enough time to write, I'm also grateful to it for the interaction that it provides with literature and students who write and people like Anne who come out and, though they say they will stay in the closet, perhaps they will not. I'm going to read some poems tonight from the brand new book that I was just handed at lunch today. And when I got ready to leave the house this evening and I looked at the book, I thought, we match. and I thought, no one would ever believe that happened by accident, but it did. So I'm going to read a few poems, well, probably about 8 or 10 or so poems from this book. And then this summer I completed a new manuscript that's called The Resurrection of the Animals, and I'm going to read some from that one also. You know, you get tired of your old poems. And when I used to go to concerts when I was you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Joan Baez, and all that. I wanted them to sing all the songs I loved, and they always sang songs I'd never heard. Now I understand why they did it. It was because they were tired of those old songs. So I'm going to read some old poems and hope I do them justice. This one is called First Learning, and it's in the first section of the book. And it begins with an epigraph from the poet Donald Hall. And the lines are, "I remember that moment because I planned at 6 in the first grade to remember the moment forever." And I think we do have a lot of moments that sometimes at the time they happen, we do plan to remember them forever, but most of them we don't, and they come back to us at other times. First learning. Smell, they say, is the corridor, the passage back through laundry and the mortgage, the rabbit hole to Wonderland. The first grade classroom, late afternoon, light drowsing around 20 children locked behind green readers. And I walk in, the new kid, in early April, friendships and hatreds already lifetimes old. Escorted by Mrs. Sipp, the principal, who tells my name and forces the small voices to give it back in chorus. But it is the smell of old wood worn slick I respond to. The chalk rail and desks, the floorboards and door frames, the cloakroom odor of lunchbox lids just lifted, and bodies too warm in their woolen leggings. I smell hands dirty and blistered from the monkey bars, the cache of fireballs confiscated to the trash. In this permanent moment, I am filed in a desk with the S's, while 40 wide eyes decide who I really am. Mrs. Overfield, my now first grade teacher, hands me a slick white paper, limp and purple inked, with words and shapes I know I must know. I lift the page to my face, sniff the damp sweetness of mimeo, the whiff which will forever mean stranger. The triangle which I see instantly does not belong in row A with those four-sided perfect squares. This one's called Elegy on a Summer Night. Tonight, cooking ears of sweet corn, I remember my grandmother at family gatherings, sharp knife in hand, shaving her corn from the cob in neat planks, leaving it planed like a 2x4 because she had false teeth. All the cousins looked on in awe as she mixed the yellow slabs with her half-runner beans and devoured the lot. "Do mine like that," we cried, elbowing close to her plate. "Me first." Tonight on the phone, my mother, a continent away, tells me my uncle, three states north of her, is hospitalized in a coma. I will not remember him like this, but in the dewy light of West Virginia summer mornings, how he arrives with buckets of chubby peaches and bushel baskets of beans, a carload of melons, and a wild Hawaiian shirt. He drops down the tailgate, cousins spill from the red wagon. "It's his heart again," she says. "It's been going for years." He's not the first to go. My uncle in Phoenix with bad lungs, and years before, my grandmother, cancer flowering in her brain. It's July once again. I'm alone in a cabin by a lake. Families camp in a park nearby. I smell dinners cooking. Wood smoke and burgers, charcoal and chicken. I think of those ritual summer picnics, relatives plentiful as fresh corn, the cousins outside for hours orbiting in the dark till ground control called us in, lightning bugs blinking the path home. Tonight, some of these cousins take planes, drive cars to the North Carolina coast, come into their father for the last time. I am nearly the age of my grandmother when she stood in that small kitchen wearing house dress and apron, sawing at the corn, surprising us with the ordinary like she did all her life. Tonight, as I watch the ducks taxi in toward their soft island nests and darkness suck light from the firs, I think of the cousins scattered random as these stars. California, Colorado, Michigan, Oklahoma, Texas, Arizona, Florida, North Carolina, Alaska. Each of us losing from the constellation of memory one more fixed body as my uncle's light fades, each of us burning a little less bright. Several years ago, when I was down at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, I needed to go get a haircut. And some of you have heard me read before know how I feel about haircuts. It's about like the same way I feel about the dentist and those sorts of things. And I have a series of haircut poems because all of my haircut experiences have been bad. And when Marsha Aldrich wrote her piece called Hair, which some of you I'm sure have heard, I was in utter sympathy with her. This is a haircut poem too, but I feel differently about it than I do the other haircut poems, and I feel differently about the person who gave me the haircut. And the poem is called Between Strangers. I pass through this town off the interstate to get gas, then see the sign next door to the Amoco, Jean's Barber Shop. I park the truck, walk in, never considering Jean might be a woman, might be black, might be someone hesitant to cut my urchin's mop. She's not sure, I can tell, but I say, just a shorter version of what I have. I can't take the heat. And she motions toward the chair. She wraps my neck, hands familiar as my mother's, her fingers in my hair tentative and unsure. I'm getting nervous, so I start to talk, find out she's from the city, lived there all her life till she came to this small town to get away from the bad stuff. She wants a garden, but is afraid of snakes. She wants to walk, but fears the ticks. We trade more talk as her scissors snip, split ends and curls drifting like the early blossoms of the flowering trees now that it's late spring. She snips, steps back to talk. I watch her hands draw stories in the air, and then she drops the conversation stopper. Her only son, bleeding to death in that city from an anonymous shotgun blast, 3 months before he was to come to her. 3 years ago, she saw him in the coffin 6 months before it happened, saw him call her from the top of a haloed stairway 6 months later. Oh, no, she said, not me. I'm staying here. She prayed her way well. Now, sometimes, the shop door opens and closes, and no one comes in. She touches my head, lifts up my hair, and I imagine that hand reaching toward that child, the boy, the man, reaching back to hair she knows the fabric of, touching the curls and waves of all her customers, feeling loss in every one. She says she's better now, then offers me the mirror to check her work. Reflected in the glass to my back, I see two women, one in a chair, the other standing above like a Victorian photo, whose lives collide in this room on a muggy day, both of us a long way from home, the air close, the cutting of hair the farthest thing from both our minds. I think a lot of us have had the experience of having the countryside we grew up in turn to suburbs. And this is a poem about that. It's called Years Later, Now the Suburbs. In light thin as an old letter, I walk the dog among the shut-tight houses, windows blank with drawn blinds, garage doors tight-lipped against asphalt. They have nothing to reveal. Husked leaves play on trimmed lawns, prim as cemetery plots. Only my dog's claws click on the blacktop. At close of day, the world seems closed, locked up in its autumn skin, wind zipping shut night's jacket. In my childhood, this was the hour for blood brothers and promises, cigarettes in the crawl space, bright candies traded for things hushed and forbidden. The heart of the neighborhood pounded inside its garb of yard and field. We perched on the edge of discovery. We prayed the voices from the open doors would crack with someone else's name. Our secrets flared like struck matches in the dark. Now that fall is upon us and Halloween is coming, I thought I have a whole series of poems in this book that are spoken by different persona, and one of the poems is called Ghost to Pumpkin, a letter. So imagine that this is a ghost writing a letter to a pumpkin. Yeah, I know. I see you there, nested in vines and bedded in leaves, your autumn orange a solid statement in a vanishing season. I know about leaves, brilliant and waxed, that flame like demons before age warps them to husks, and winds thrash them to dust. Where are their lights now in this gray between season? But there you are, colorfully napping, sturdy enough to thump on, plump as an overgrown persimmon, thoroughly grounded. Do you dream of a gossamer self, able to slip from the knotted grasses, able to rise above your squashed body like steam from a pot? Do you wonder what it's like to be fingered by the wind, to hold the wind, to be the wind? When you are snatched from your patch for the carving, which will happen, will you feel the knife rip your tight-lipped skin? Is this the source of hollow sound? Eyes, nose, teeth that would be an orthodontist's delight? You become the carver's worst fear, the hostess's clever art, the child's lantern. Light will glow in your belly, fire dance in your eyes. How I would like to hold your warmth, your burning, your flame that for a moment transforms such ordinary night. Horsemen clatter along the boards of memory. The moon ducks behind whipped clouds, pie round and smiling. There's a whole series of poems, as I said, in here in various voices, and some of the titles are things like "The Muse Speaks in Four Voices," "The Printer Considers Her Artistic Heritage," "The Former Nun Confesses," "The Lover Takes a Letter from Her Mailbox," "The English Teacher in Midlife," imagine that. And this is one called "The Minister Takes a Back Road on Her Way to Church." Notice how along the back roads, Queen Anne's lace breaks out in long-stemmed constellations. They grow unnoticed, so common and so plentiful. Watch how the raven rides on air. We do not see how he finds the way to use its lift to arrow him home. He is darkness making his way toward light. See the placement of barns and Holsteins, silo bracing the shed, old fences giving in to slope. Once red, once white, they return to the fabric of trees. A train rips along beside me. What hymn do I hear in its wheels? "Stay with me, stay with me, stay with me," they say. I pull the truck to the side of the road, watch the train with its cargo of wishes go on. I step out onto gravel, loose footing, lift off toward the tangible comfort of stars. And this is a little poem. There are two poems in this book called "The Poets." One, the first one is called "The Poet Speaks the Early Years," and the second one is called "The Poet Speaks the Later Years." It is my hope that the second poem is far superior to the first. And it's also my hope that you will see eventually, when you are bogged down in the middle of the first poem and can't get through it, that there is something wrong with it. And I hope you realize also that I realize that. But I use it because I wanted to show the contrast between the kind of writing I learned to do in graduate school and the kind of writing I learned to do on my own with the help of other poets who were not in the academy. This is called "The Poet Speaks the Later Years." Gone from home for as long as I lived here, I hear your voice on the phone for the first time in years, giving directions to roads I know by heart, telling me how to find you in the countryside so altered I'll be startled as Alice at the bottom of the rabbit hole, or Van Winkle yawning his way back into town. It's spring, just spring, in the Appalachians. As I drive deeper into the valleys, sadness cloisters me like a diaphanous veil. It's the light, I think, the way the late evening light offers solace for what losses we can't even know, or the way the light in this last hour before dark entices us into memory. This is the light in your voice as it falls on my ear. I am drawn to what I took years leaving behind, to the girl left hanging on the low limb of the persimmon. The light down this valley reels me in like a fish. I sound out the words on the signs, names that fit like a shed skin. I go toward the center of this venerable grief, expectation gathering now like faint stars. And speaking of stars, I'll read the first poem in the last section is a poem called "Stars." And where I grew up in West Virginia, in the mountains, in the summer with no air conditioning, it was hot in these little cinder block houses. And one of the things we did, we had a little concrete porch out front that we called the terrace, which was about half the size of this table. And we would go out there and sleep at night. And one of my fond, we'd sleep on army cots that my father had. And one of my fond memories is lying there in the dark with my parents, with my father pointing out the constellations. And this is called Stars. There's a brother in this poem who was not there then, but he is in the poem. Stars. Are they out there or not? I asked myself, a kid squat on the back stoop, elbows on knees, chin in hands, pale frog on the cement pad. It was a close August night. The whole family wandered the house, the yard, ghost-like in the sticky air. My mother in her Milky Way nightgown, my father in cotton shorts, my brother in whatever he wore when he slipped into sleep. I knew the light from those stars meant nothing, that the flickers I watched might be long burned out, no pulse at all. Where I saw flame, no match. Where I saw spark, no flint. From behind me, pushing through darkness and heat, my mother's voice called my father, "Come to bed." And I wondered, by the time those syllables lit up my ears, did she still lean in the doorway, or already lie in another room, lost in night's heaven, night's mystery? And I'll read the final poem in this collection, which is called Anonymous. My grandmother told me only that living in the past was no good, and never mentioned my grandfather drowned trying to save another man. My mother read me stories from the Bible and a child's garden of verses. Happy stories, she said, because life has enough sorrow you don't need to add more. Aunt Marie never said she was first married to a handsome, luckless boy killed during the war until I found the photo no one could explain. And Aunt Phyllis neglected to say she was desperate until my uncle lay dying in the next room. Silence was the haunted field each walked home through alone, afraid that to cry out was to give away her position. What they couldn't see in the darkness, those shapes, those movements they took for lost souls, were more women like themselves, women tiptoeing lightly as the sounds of ghosts, the whisper of frost. What they couldn't hear was a legion of secrets denied speech like a dog denied water after a long run. A pack of women drinking could be a dangerous thing, a pride of females, an ostentation of ladies. One drop of the sweet liquid, they'd want more. Now my cousin tells me what happened to her at 16, and I tell her why I've lived with the same friend all these years. My friend tells me how she knew on the night of her wedding it was a mistake, and her friend relates that when her mother died, she felt nothing but joy. Gossip, some people would say, idle tongues. I tell you these stories are your own. You have taken them in like a foster child. I tell you a true story is a strange thing. It is a poem missing the final lines, and you are at your desk already writing. So that's kind of a sample of what's in there. And so I want to read some things from the newer manuscript, The Resurrection of the Animals. And this is the title poem, although the book is about... It's not all a book about animals, for those of you who don't want the dogs brought in the house. I'll relieve your anxieties. But it is a poem, a collection, I think, about transformation and magic and resurrection, not necessarily of people and animals, but of ideas and of hopes and of dreams and some of those kinds of things. But this is the section on the animals is the last in the collection, and this is the title poem from that part of the book, The Resurrection of the Animals. For most of them, no waiting, no slow lifetimes packed away underground. They do not trouble with theological questions. Will I recognize my family on the other side? Which of my sins will count most? Where is hell, really? In that irreversible snap of transition between the chasing of something, a scent, a memory, across the highway to the impact of metal and pressure of tires, the hound's curiosity splinters into spectrums of light, the body dropping, useless now. In autumn, the blood of the dog flows back in the black-red growth trimming the road. The lamb, the calf, the hog, peering from the slatted, rattling truck at an awkwardly jolting world, flee with the butcher's blow into the unfenced, unpinned night. While their bodies are carved for the table, they pasture among stars. In winter, the fleece of sheep lies banked in their former fields. The rabbit, the coyote, the deer, all the earth's hunted, romp, sudden herds of wind when the bullet lasers through their lives. They are not asked to forgive their enemies. They make the air electric as they pass. This is a poem called August. There's also a section in the book with a poem from each month of the year. And this is the August poem, which I thought was particularly appropriate to read now as we are all going back to school. And you'll see why. It's called August. Only 2 days away, August approaches the house like news of the plague. I feel its dark wings already preparing to fold me in their treacherous feathers, all the while protesting they are bright with heat, that they fly the flags of summer vacation, of endless leisure days, that they ferry us on soft gull wings across the lake, resplendent with tilting sails. But I know August. When August slams into town with its suspicious laughter and sleight of hand, I see that hand unlatch its sideshow trunk, ease up the lid on a coffin where days of sunrise walks along the shore, bleed of color, road maps for later excursions waste away, starved and thin. August says, "Hey, I'm just a tourist in this town, tossing his trash from Burger King on my lawn. Not to worry." August kicks open the schoolhouse door, drags us in, hostage for another year, leaves me with a hunger not even the autumn harvest can relieve. I think if I could write the perfect kind of poetry, I would write lyric poetry, because I love the lyric, and I love the compression of thought and emotion, and I love the musicality of it, and I think that's what a poem does, is what the lyric poem does. But I seem to be, in many ways, more of a narrative poet than a lyric poet, and so when I do write a lyric, whether it's good or not, I'm happy. And this is a little one called Becoming Haiku. How in October, the world reduces itself to a few syllables. Red leaf, a slick spark, frost sharp day. I come walking early with the dog straining at her leash, nose poking at crystal grass, but nothing shatters. The morning sits still as a room with a secret, where I find myself shedding everything but my bones and skin, this coat, the shape keeping me intact. Like the red leaf, I break off the branch, become singular, and begin my inward curl. I think October does that to us. Several of you, I think, have heard me read this poem, and I always say at the beginning that I always wanted to write a poem about linoleum, which is true, and maybe it's because most of the houses I grew up in my childhood were paved with linoleum. And the interesting thing about this is, a couple summers ago when I wrote this, in 1 week, I read two other writers who talked about linoleum. So I felt if they could do it, Alice Munro and Tess Gallagher, I could do it too. And the poem begins with two epigraphs, one from Munro and one from Gallagher. Alice Munro's is from her novel Lives of Girls and Women, which takes place in the town of Jubilee. And the quote is, "People's lives in Jubilee, as elsewhere, were dull, simple, amazing, unfathomable. Deep caves paved with kitchen linoleum." And Tess Gallagher's quote is, "Overwhelmed by the loneliness of the saints, I take up my broom and begin where I stand with linoleum." I want to say something about it too, Tess and Alice. All those dull floors of the mountain homes, about the impossible colors mashed into a mixture of cork and linseed spread over a burlap backing. The pea soup green of our 7th Avenue kitchen, the baby turd brown of the church basement, the crab shell salmon in the tiny rooms rented from Miss Winifred Rue, turquoise and orange triangles on sky blue, mud gray stripes flecked with gold suns. The floors I track on when I step back in time, string mop in hand, cracked, glued down to warped boards, rippling like a stream as it flows through a hallway in three rooms. I'm back in the house of someone's great aunt in Kentuck, West Virginia. Something has happened, I can tell from church ladies who bring jello salad and beans, chicken and kale greens, high-backed chairs rocking their creaky talk in the parlor, my small body cold like this house and low to the ground, but I see linoleum swirling through the rooms, me wading along it, into it, voices high up like birdsong in lamps, on mantel and clock, then somewhere beyond linoleum, a woman cries. I left West Virginia. I went to undergraduate school in West Virginia, and then I left in 1968, and went to graduate school in Ohio, and then went to teach in Kansas in 72. And my parents retired and moved from West Virginia to Florida in 1980. And I didn't go back to West Virginia between 1980 and 1990. And the first time I went back, I was driving from Florida back up to Michigan, and Beth was with me, and we stopped in West Virginia, and my mother asked that we plant some flowers on my grandmother's grave. And this is a poem about that experience. It's called Digging with Spoons. We bring plants to my grandmother's grave, geraniums because my mother always did, marigolds because I think they will survive if the others succumb, impatience because you are with me and they are your choice. Since I've been missing from this place for 30 years, I follow the map my mother gave me on the phone. But I know this hill, the narrow road, the smell of grass that always conjures up the pink granite stone, the bucket of water sloshing in my adolescent hand, the trowel mud-caked and bent. This morning we realize we have no tools, passing through this town on our way from vacation to home, nothing to spade up the hard earth and insert summer bloom. But we have two wooden spoons and a Swiss Army knife, so we start to dig. You hacking at the grass to the side of the stone, me scooping a depression at the center in front. The dirt is stubborn, permanent as loss. You go for water to the faucet. I will a slot to open before the name, a pocket to hold this overdue gift. I curse the spoon, thinking how all her life my grandmother had to do with what she had, never having the best or the newest of anything. She would see this digging, this chopping at the earth with a blunt blade, as unremarkable, a matter of course. She would give thanks for something besides hands. Summer before this past one, I spent about a month in Vancouver doing some research on a Canadian studies project I was working on and doing some writing, and I had a wonderful room. Those of you who've been on the campus of the University of British Columbia, their residence towers go about 20 floors up in the air. And I was on the 17th floor with a huge window that looked out onto English Bay. And I could see the barges and the cruise ships and the freighters and everything going by. And it was wonderful. And it also reminded me, those of you who went to camp may know the old camp song called Barges that starts out, I'm not going to sing it, but it starts out of my window passing in the night, I can see the barges flickering light. Silently flows the river to the sea, and the barges, they go silently. And then you sing it in a round. But the epigraph to this poem is, out of my window passing in the night, I can see the barges flickering light. It's called Barges. For 11 days I've watched from my high window the boats on English Bay. They travel on this gray plain from Vancouver to Seattle and Victoria, to Alaska and places I can't name. Sharp sailboats circle like white-finned sharks. Ferries plod along beside them, and cruise ships cut through the water with their steel laughter, haughty in their racks of lifeboats and jazz band playing on the upper deck. But it's the barges I watch for, binoculars skimming over pleasure boats and tankers. What is this romance with the barge? Rectangular bin sunk almost to water level with its weight of lumber and sand, boxes and crates, workhorse among the painted ponies and rodeo mares. When I was a child, I watched the river near my home carry the burden of coal, 6, 7, 8 barges long, the tug sputtering like it might go under, the fractured heart of my mountain transplanted to another state. No hulls with colored wings, no speedboats pulling skiers, no stern wheeler of gamblers, cards flying before gunshots. Only the barges, steady and dependable, ran the river. Some tangible sadness in their silent passing, north and south. Some sense in me of the life of work, simple and necessary. Now I watch them in another country, sunset streaking by like a comet, as I sit at my desk to write. My cargo of words floated on lines as on a river. The heart blasted and mined into dark, hard rocks, each one capable of fire. This is I like to write funny poems, and I realize not many of these have been funny. So I'm going to read one called Marie's Trees, and I don't know, some of you might know Marie Swanson, who's with the Cancer Institute here, but she very graciously offered Beth and I some of her trees, and these were maples that were growing on her bank that were sort of like this, and she didn't want them, and we moved into a house that had virtually no trees, so we went down with some friends who wanted some trees too and dug them up, and the poem's called Marie's Trees. We dug them in the ripe spring when they unfurled green flags in surrender or welcome, the thin maples rooted at acute angles on the steep bank. A neighbor's cat, curious about spades and mattocks, buckets and bags, tumble grin through our ankles among hands, blitzing and vanishing, a feline phoenix rising from the scrap leaves while we potted and packed. We drove them 50 miles, rolled them into fresh holes, staked them upright, mounding dirt at their base. I remember the young calico we had in Kansas who went missing. We gave her up for dead, though no body lay in the roadway. 12 days later, she returned, one-dimensional thin, and never again left the backyard. We think she got trapped in a workman's truck, taken across town, had to whiff her way home with whisker radar, green eyes plotting the calculus of paws. I push hard on the dirt around this tree, needing it to rise. Imagine some dawn while I'm still sleeping, a leaping of squalling leaves into the air, roots ripped loose, dangling, the kidnapped saplings headed home. Hasn't happened yet. Just a couple more, and this one has some humor in it too, I think. And I wrote it because I came across an essay by Sandra Alcosser, who's a poet. And this was a sentence she had in the essay. Neurobiologists speculate that memory, like pain, does not reside in a single place, but floats like smoke through the body. And I love that idea of memory just sort of moving around inside us and not being anchored up here in the head. So the poem's called The Store of Things. Where is it you are camped tonight? Just off the pulmonary artery? The islets of Langerhans? Or the banks of the alimentary canal? When I find myself off balance, I know you are on the move. I put up keep off signs in danger spots. Tear ducts, eardrum, the steep cliffs of the heart from where a fall is always fatal. You're as hard to track as the abominable snowman. I hear your caws like coyote echo from clavicle to sternum through the canyon of the abdomen. Now there, your raven wings flap up toward the rafter of ribs. There's a stutter in my breath. You are loose in my chest like a bad cough, rumbling along somewhere out of sight, causing an outburst at exactly the wrong time. I think you are headed nowhere in your tinker's wagon, rickety wheels just around the next vertebra, maybe under the patella. You've stopped to gather wood, knowing how to keep us both warm when the forecast is fierce. Okay, three more. This one's called Frog Moon. Somebody said, is there a frog moon? And I said, well, look that way to me. What was it there croaking in the dark pond of night? What was it lurking self-important among the foliage of clouds? What was it that made me hear my name struck like a drum as I lay sleeping alone in the pod of the old adobe and rise to open the window on the shoreline of dreams? There you sat, frog moon, puffed up like a crystal ball, full of knowledge and mystery, but not talking. I felt your deep breathing, your dead-to-the-world demeanor, your smug example, as you napped, while below someone lit another cigarette, someone opened a door, someone tried to catch your eye. Was it you who called my name, Frog Moon, as I paddled my canoe along the rivers of sleep? Was it you who woke me to this liquid black, the rising tide of the Milky Way? Your webbed foot flight through the sky that leaves me splashed with stars. I don't know if some of you have ever had the experience of perhaps having a pet who has died, and sometime later you experience another animal that seems to you to be that pet, or that pet seems to have come back to you in some way. And I had a beagle who died that I had that experience with, and not once but twice, and the poem's called Witness. Dusk, and with two slices of old bread, I go to the water looking for the ducks, hoping they're looking for me. Across the lake, the voices of two men about to motor off in a rowboat carry my way. They are talking about the plentiful bluegill, how many they will catch. Along the narrow inlet, the Canada geese preen and nibble at careless movements in twig and moss. When I toss bread into the water, they will not come. I quack, noticing a woman on the dock by her house notice me. From beneath the boards, one duck lifts off, only a foot or so above the water, flaps quacking my way and hydroplanes to my shoreline. I can't believe he has flown straight to me. I tear small chunks, communion size, and chuck them beside him. He gobbles them all, then starts up the rocky bank between us, his flat webbed feet slapping the stones, puckering like suction cups. I bend toward him and he snatches the crumb from my fingers, his narrow bill snapping shut on my thumb, tugging. He is not afraid. I want to reach down and ferry him to the grass, my fingers floating through his iridescent feathers, touch the thick fans of his feet. When I offer no more bread, he plops back to the water, circles like a skater, swims out, then comes back as if he knows there's more and he's just waiting. He quacks and jabbers to himself, or perhaps to me, as he paddles back toward the dock, and suddenly I see the dog I loved in the tilt of his head, his eager eye, her quirky barking and his random quacks, something familiar in his hesitation to go. She died 5 years ago, but made her first return to me exactly 1 year later as I slept in a tent in the Catalina foothills, coyotes howling around me all hours of the night. One voice was different, was hers, and I knew she'd come back, a noisy clue in the mystery about us. Tonight, as I walk the path back to the cabin, I know she's come again, from exile in web and feather, saying there is a different redemption in bread, in water, as well as in the desert stars, saying that, when the time comes, the world will open out like a bright question, shape of leaf, print of paw, sinew of light. And this is the final poem, which is the final poem in the Resurrection of the Animals collection. This morning, the trees have stopped sighing, stopped rocking, ceased shaking their sky-bound heads, which, on the ends of slender white necks, shook no, 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 all night, as I, too, tossed in the motionless dark, in the tight air. In my dream, a young woman I loved in adolescence galloped along this beach on a horse that flicked water from his hooves like loose stars, like liquid change, like a shattered vase of light. I felt the slivers prick my face, but she did not see me, near enough to hear the horse's teeth bite air. Before sleep, walking the dogs on the beach, I watched five Canada geese nod on the swell near the shore when the dogs spied their small fleet. They hit the water in quick release, only their furry heads visible as the geese headed out to sea, the dogs forgetting their legs weren't fins. Once I lost a dog to drowning. My heart swam with these dogs through the choppy water, tugging at their names, trying to herd them back to shore, and when they both turned, finally, though the geese with their winged surprise urged them on, I found myself waist-deep in waves, arms extended in magnetic hope, trying to pull all things forgotten from the deep. Thank you. A lot of the poems in the book are poems in which the speaker does go back into memory and is calling into the present, I think, some of those things from the past. That's right. Yeah, at least in the ones I read. And I think even in some of the sections where the speakers are not the poet, well, a lot of them, I think that still happens. That's a good observation. Yeah. Well, I feel very Southern, but I think that's not true of all of West Virginia. The part that I grew up in, and you know, those of you who know your history know that during the American Civil War, West Virginia was a border state and was very divided in its allegiances to the North and the South, and I think a lot of that still carries over. And I grew up in the southwestern part and went to college almost on the Virginia border, In fact, when I was in college in the 60s, the dance was still called the Confederate Ball, and the guys all wore Confederate uniforms. And at football games, they flew the Confederate flag, and I find that astounding now, even for the mid-60s. But my mother's family was in Richmond, Virginia, and Florida, and North Carolina, and places like that. And my father's family was all in rural West Virginia. But I was closer and spent more time with my mother's family. So I think that Southern connection was very strong, and have always felt myself much more a Southerner than a Northerner. Although people say you don't have a Southern accent, you have a mountain accent, and that's right. The only time I get upset is when they say, "Are you from Texas?" And I say, "No." Well, it's very hot in here tonight. I thank you all for coming out on Friday night to hear the reading, and I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much.